Hello and welcome to the podcast BFI Talks, which is brought to you by Prague Finance Institute at the leading Czech economics research center, Sergej EI. It is my pleasure to welcome Peter Oppenheimer, head of macro research in Europe at Goldman Sachs. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for finding time at, you know, in these sort of trying COVID times. And it's been great to hear during our chat early on that, you know, Britain is sort of well ahead of the curve in terms of like, you know, relative to European, other European countries in terms of vaccination and everything, that schools have started reopening. So we still have to, we still have some ground to catch up in the Czech Republic. But without any further ado, let's focus on what we wanted to talk to you about today, because we know your time is precious. You know, as an analyst, you have covered financial markets for, you know, over three decades. Have you ever experienced anything similar, you know, when looking at crises before that would be like the COVID crisis or COVID-induced stress that the world economy or global economy has gone through?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the answer is no. I think this is completely unprecedented, really, in so many ways. I mean, first point is a very obvious one, that, you know, most recessions and previous financial crises have been driven by some kind of economic problem, you know, rising inflation or rising interest rates, perhaps a collapse in asset prices, a deleveraging of parts of the economy. Whereas this recession, which has been a global recession and a very deep one, really had very little to do with economic stresses to begin with, but was really the function of government policies deliberately aimed at preventing economic activity and mobility to contain the virus. So it had very different causes, but it's also been very unique, really, because of its depth and its speed. I mean, both of those are quite extraordinary. You know, this has been one of the deepest global recessions, certainly in the last six or seven decades. In the UK, where I live, if you look at the annual contraction last year, probably of nearly 10%, that was the biggest annual contraction for about 300 years. Mm-hmm. But it's also been incredibly short. If you look at the recession period itself, take the US, you know, only 2 months, the first part of the recession. And if you compare it, let's say, to, you know, the Great Depression, where there was a collapse of GDP of 25% and a rise of unemployment of around 25%, which took place over 4 years. We saw in the US last year a fall of GDP of about 15%, a rise in unemployment of about 11%, but that all happened in 2 months. So I think really quite unprecedented.
Well, from what you've said and based on the book that you published last year, you know, the Long Goodbye, you know, covering market cycles, do you think you will have to actually update the book? Because, you know, this in terms of cycles, this is, as you say, it has been unprecedented.
Yeah, I certainly would like to. I think that there's some interesting lessons that we're learning from this crisis. There are also some important points about cycles that are repeated. And even in this very unusual climate that we've been in, there are some parts of what we're seeing which reflect cycles in the past. And really what I was trying to get at in the book, The Long Goodbye, is that you do get repeated patterns in economic cycles and financial market cycles in really very, very different conditions, high inflation, low inflation, periods of rapid technological advance, periods where there is little technological advance, and times when you have very different political conditions. So you do get repeated patterns. I would say, you know, what we have seen this time, although everything has been concertinaed, shortened in time, is that, you know, the recovery that we've seen, for example, in risk assets and equities, while it's been very sharp, you know, has started during the recession while profits are still falling, as investors start to anticipate a recovery supported by policy. That, in a sense, is quite typical of what we've seen in other situations previously. It's just policy setting has been very much more aggressive. So I think it's the it's the combination of extremely supportive monetary policy with fiscal policy, which really makes this current environment particularly interesting in the context of the sorts of cycles we've seen in the last 50 or 60 years.
It's interesting that you've mentioned that brought the sort of subject back, you know, to, you know, equity markets, because, you know, at least the United States, you know, stock markets there have bounced back very quickly. I mean, depending on what sort of indicators you look at, you know, European stocks have sort of only now catching up and getting to the pre-COVID levels. I mean, hasn't the decoupling of the reaction by the, especially US stock market, been sort of too much relative to what's going on, you know, in the broader economy and in the sort of pandemic situations in the wider society? Sort of the difference between Wall Street and Main Street.
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. Actually, if you look at the trajectory of recoveries from bear market troughs in equities and around recessions, the recovery we've seen almost exactly now in a year since the crisis started, and the equity markets reached a trough, it's been much stronger than the average, absolutely right. But actually, it's been very similar to the kind of pace of rebound we saw in equities in the year following the financial crisis, which, remember, reached its trough in March 2009. There are some important differences, though. Bear in mind that the financial crisis, again, took place over quite a long period of time, and equities fell very sharply. You know, most equity markets fell roughly about 60% from peak to trough. Whereas last year, over a very short period, a couple of months or so, most equity markets fell about 30%. So it does raise the question of why the rebound has been so rapid, given that markets didn't fall that much, even in the worst part of the start of the pandemic. And I think the reason for this really is to do with the extraordinary policy support that we've seen. Now, bear in mind that because of the financial crisis and the tools that were put in place in the aftermath of that, quantitative easing, for example, it was very possible to act very, very quickly in the light of this current crisis. So we saw interest rates, policy rates fall back towards zero in any countries where they could still do that. Of course, across much of Europe, rates were already negative, so that wasn't possible. Quantitative easing was re-accelerated, and balance sheets in the central banks have grown very sharply again. But also, because there wasn't the same moral hazard as we saw in the financial crisis, the fear of bailing out parts of the economy that may have been seen to be to blame for the financial crisis. Of course, this particular crisis was of no one's making, it was of no one's fault. So I think it was easier for governments to step in very quickly with an increase in fiscal policy. And of course, this fiscal expansion that we've seen has been really very, very dramatic indeed in most major economies, and particularly in the US, which not only increased fiscal spending very quickly in the aftermath of the start of this crisis, but then we saw the very big package at the end of last year. And again, of course, the package that the new administration passed just very recently, these are unprecedented sums. And it's this combination together, which I think have helped investors see through the depth of the economic downturn and start to price this future recovery. And we do think the economic recovery is going to be very rapid as mobility starts to improve. And that's really, I think, is what has justified the markets rebounding so quickly. And lastly, I would say that the combination of fiscal and monetary support has helped investors get more comfortable that there'll be less structural problems or scarring of economies that might have otherwise happened in a downturn of this depth.
It sort of actually opens two themes of questions, and I'll try to very simplify. One is actually about the role the role of governments, the fiscal expansion and central banks. Because when the great financial crisis occurred, or the reaction was like, there was all this talk about, you know, this is probably the end of the road for like fiscal expansion or central bank sort of quantitative easing intervention. You know, what if another crisis comes? How far can these institutions go? And they obviously have gone, you know, a step further, or maybe even more steps further. And you've just described it that probably the moral hazard or the lack of it has played a significant role in it. So can they actually really go any further from where they are now? That would be my first thematic question on what you've just said.
Well, I think that, you know, the scale of the crisis that the global economy has faced, both and the of course the medical crisis first and foremost, was so great that I think really extraordinary things had to happen, and quite a major way and in a coordinated way, and for that reason I think all of the policy support that we've seen has certainly been justified. And it was absolutely right that governments, I think, also extended fiscal support to directly support or indirectly support businesses and the labour market, because again, many businesses had to shut for no fault of their own. Many people couldn't go into work for no fault of their own. So it was essential that government stepped in, you know, to support people, which in many, many cases they have done so. You know, could they do more? Yes, I think they could. I mean, it's difficult, you know, to get interest rates down again, given that they're already negative in nominal terms, certainly across Europe, and in real terms, when you take account of inflation, in most places, interest rates are negative. But I think there could be more fiscal support as well. And, you know, I suppose one of the fortunate things that has occurred is that this need for fiscal expansion has happened at a time when the cost of debt has fallen to these all-time record low levels. So governments can really justify increased borrowing because the debt burden, given the current levels of interest rates, is so low. So I think more could potentially be done if required. But if we're right in our forecast that we really do see a very strong rebound, this year we're looking at global real GDP of a little over 6.5% and a little over 4.5% next year. That combined would be really the strongest pace of global growth probably since the early 1980s. And that will help to start to bring down debt levels and make further support less necessary.
Mm-hmm. Well, and when I go back to the sort of direct assistance that the U.S. both U.S. administrations, that the Trump ones and the new Joe Biden's administration have done, they've actually put in practice the long discussed concept of helicopter money. I mean, would you agree with that? Look at the support that has been done on just like these checks, fiscal checks that people have been receiving.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it in a form, yes. I think the decision rightly is that you need to, instead of just cutting taxes, perhaps a more traditional form of fiscal easing, get money directly to people to help them to bridge the gap between the current period where many people are not working to the period of recovery. And obviously, if you're giving that to people, that can keep consumption going. One of the encouraging things, of course, is that the savings rate in the household sector in the US, but not just in the US, right across Europe as well and many other places, has increased dramatically. So there's a kind of excess force savings. People's incomes have been relatively stable because of these direct payments or subsidies or furlough schemes. They've taken different forms in different places. And of course, many people could not consume in the way that they would ordinarily do because most things have been shut. Savings rates have gone up a lot. And I think this is creating an environment where, as mobility improves, as the vaccine programs become more extensive, we'll see quite a strong consumer-led recovery. And I think that the more innovative, flexible approach to fiscal policy that's being used, you know, really, really makes some sense in the context of the sort of crisis that we've seen. Mm-hmm.
One question on the sort of a slightly different ways of this this fiscal support taking place on the on both sides of the Atlantic. Is it, maybe it's too early to sort of give any, you know, judgment or any opinion on that, but do you think that the US approach that was actually based on the furloughs, you know, really pretty much making, you know, getting people out of work and just, you know, keeping them effectively unemployed, while in Europe there are all these various complex schemes of actually incentivizing companies to keep people on their payroll, even though for shorter weeks. And do you think that these two approaches are, you know, what the advantages or disadvantages of these two approaches are, in your opinion?
Well, I think in a way they're both designed to do the same thing. And I don't think necessarily one is better than the other. You know, they're both there in place to prevent structural significant rises in unemployment as businesses have had to stop doing their normal activity. If there was no direct support for labour by governments, you would see very significant unemployment that could quite quickly become structural. Of course, that's what you have seen in some previous recessions, and most famously, of course, in the Great Depression. So I think, you know, there's been clearly a desire to prevent that sort of thing happening. And I think in both cases, on both sides of the Atlantic, it's been broadly successful. You haven't seen unemployment rising nearly as much as many of the forecasts were suggesting a year ago. And in fact, it did rise very quickly, in particular in the US to begin with, but has started to come down much more quickly. So I think in that sense, it's been very, you know, very helpful. But I think the main objective, and generally speaking, I think it's been a success, is to prevent structural rises in unemployment, to provide workers and families the wherewithal, the ability to continue to survive through this downturn, and then build up some savings so that you can really kickstart quite a vigorous consumer-led recovery as mobility starts to improve. So I think both have been successful in that mm-hmm. sense.
Well, any consumer-driven recovery is going to fuel inflation. Are we to expect a return of maybe even like the 70s, like, you know, inflation levels?
I think that's very unlikely. As the central banks, firstly, let's be clear. I mean, inflation in most major economies, not all economies, but in most major, certainly developed economies, is still well below the central bank's target rates. And that's true even in the US, certainly true across Europe. And most central banks, I think, would argue that because of the scale of this downturn, there is plenty of spare capacity. There is spare capacity in the labor markets and in the product markets as well. So that it will take some time with a vigorous recovery before you really start to get aggregate prices rising towards or above the target rates that would, for example, justify higher interest rates. Now, of course, there are areas, pockets of tightness, which are already leading to some sharp price rises. We've seen it, of course, in the commodity space. Mm-hmm. Commodity markets are very tight. There's been years of underinvestment during a decade of relatively low commodity prices. And as demand gradually turns, you know, you're getting a squeeze in capacity and rising prices. You're seeing it in other areas like semiconductors, for example. But the question is really whether this becomes an aggregate increase in prices. We do think we're moving into a more reflationary cycle where average inflation will be higher than we were seeing in the last decade, where there was a glut of global savings, where the rapid technological innovations were very deflationary, where globalization was very deflationary. these things are not ending, but at the margin, I think we're shifting to an environment where, coupled with more vigorous, expansive monetary and fiscal policy, you could see generally higher prices. But I don't think like the sort of increases we were seeing in the 1970s. And I think also central banks believe that they can control inflation if it picks up much more easily than they can control deflation, which has really been the major risk of the last decade or so that they've been consistently fighting. So I think a more reflationary environment, but not a high inflation environment, would be our expectation.
Okay. But since you mentioned globalization, or maybe a sort of like a slowing down of globalization, or maybe sort of like looking down upon, you know, globalization among some sort of policymakers, so you would discount any sort of fears of that lack of or easing of globalization would actually push the prices up, you know, increase the costs?
I think it will increase costs. And again, the question is the distribution. You know, one of the things that we've seen over the period of rapidly uncontested globalization, which has been supported, of course, by technological innovations in the last 20 or 25 years, has been, you know, a relentless rise in profit margins and profit shares of GDP. That's also been supported by a trend of declining corporation taxes, generally speaking, over that period. Now, you know, as you see some challenges to globalization, some of it makes sense in the because of, you know, concerns about security of supply chains. Mm-hmm. Some of it makes sense because the cost differences that were a key motivator of globalization in the last decade or two are beginning to, you know, to moderate. So, you know, many companies are finding it more economical to onshore production. And of course, the technology means that, local production can be much more efficient than it was many, many years ago. Now, these things could push up prices in certain areas, absolutely. The question is, you know, how much will that be taken on by margins in companies? How much of it will be passed forward? A lot of that really ultimately depends also on what happens to wages and how much wages increase. So I think, again, many of these things together would suggest that the deflationary pressures that dominated really since the beginning of this millennium may start to moderate in favor of some price increases. But generally, I think that, you know, that is seen by policymakers as probably quite a good thing, as long as it doesn't,
go into another extreme.
The target rates that they've been trying to achieve and not really able to for many, many years now.
So you think that, for example, we've seen, for example, let's look at specifically a 10-year treasury bond. So we've seen since the beginning of the year, we've seen the yields going to, you know, about 1.7, just about 1.5%. Do you think the Fed will let it go about, you know, let it go to 2% or even above, or will sort of employ what they've hinted at on like sort of balancing out or sort of easing the curve? I'm not sure whether it's the real life, you know, the real terminology, the actual terminology they've used.
Yes, well, often people talk about sort of yield curve control. I think that's not directly likely. I mean, they do have some control over the shape of the yield curve through forward guidance, what they're telling the markets they're expecting to do with with policy rates, and also, of course, the level of policy rates. And as we've heard just recently, by the Federal Reserve, for example, they continue to guide quite aggressively that they're likely to keep rates on hold with no changes really until probably late 2023, early 2024. In the case of Europe, probably well beyond that. And that is really anchoring the, you know, long-term yields to some degree. Now, very long-term yields have increased, so the yield curve has steepened. That's consistent with rising inflationary pressures and greater confidence in growth. And I don't think they'd be overly alarmed by that. And bear in mind that the kind of levels of bond yields we're talking about here are still negative in real terms. Mm-hmm. So they are still very, very low, and that's still conducive with, you know, the expected recovery in economic activity and a prospective increase in investment spending. I think, you know, there's some upside risk to the current bond yields. Our bond strategists are forecasting US 10 yields to go to 1.9% over the course of the next several months. But I think to break out significantly above that, you would either need to have a big inflation shock or you know, the markets to be convinced that the central banks are going to raise rates much earlier. Mm-hmm.
And moving on the other side of the sort of policy coin, and that is you know, fiscal and taxation policies. Should investors sort of take into account or consider a much more acutely a higher likelihood of higher taxes?
Yeah, I think this is a very good point. You know, we should recognize that one of the legacy effects of this crisis has been much higher levels of government debt. And again, that's not seen as a problem at the moment. It's seen as part of the solution. And it's also not seen as a worry for the financial markets because interest rates are so low that, you know, governments can finance these higher levels of debt. But in time, I think there is going to be much more focus on debt sustainability. And we have seen indications that corporate taxes are likely to rise. Remember, President Biden in his election campaign argued that he would raise statutory corporation taxes from 21% to 28%, partially reversing the cut from a rate of 35% passed in 2017. Now, whether we get to that or not, we'll see. But I think things are certainly moving in that direction here in the UK as well. In the last budget, while there was not an increase in the corporation tax, the Chancellor did talk about the prospect of gradually raising corporation taxes over a period of time. They're particularly low in the UK. So I think we're beginning to see some moves in that direction and may well see more over time. But I think that there are other potential sources of taxation as well that may be pursued over time. You know, there's a question, of course, of digital taxes. Mm-hmm. And there's also questions around things like carbon taxes, which would be consistent with the growing ambitions of most economies to get to net zero carbon, to decarbonize their economy. So I think over time, there will be pressures to raise taxation and to find new sources of taxation that can help to, you know, pay for these higher levels of debt.
You know, since the beginning of the year, and maybe even during the last year, the whole pandemic, you know, stricken year, we've witnessed what some people call democratization of stock investing. So what do you expect stock markets will do when all these sort of retail investors, and there's a lot of them, and we've seen that they can actually move some assets quite significantly. What do you think is going to happen to these markets when these people can finally get relief from their lockdowns and just go out about and not to be sort of spending time on computer screens and playing stock markets?
Yeah, well, look, I think, you know, some of this is a function, as you say, of this very unusual environment. People have been getting direct payments. You know, many people have been at home, not working every day. And so there's time. Rates are at zero, roughly, and central banks are saying that that's going to continue. So there's a combination of things that has led to, you know, more retail investing. But I think, again, we need to put this in context. You know, if you look, for example, in the US in the last decade or so, you know, the only net buyer of equities consistently has been the corporate sector itself through increased share purchases, mm-hmm. as companies have tried to take advantage of very cheap debt relative to the cost of equity. But generally speaking, other institutions, pension funds, insurance companies, households have been reducing in net their exposure to equities. And, you know, that's again reflected what was a very uncertain decade in terms of economic growth and inflation. And of course, falling bond yields. I think that as confidence in forward economic growth increases, and perhaps to your point, investors perceive that there's some degree of inflation, I think there will be a natural desire to move out of cash and government bonds into more real assets like equities to provide some growth and protection against inflation. So we might see gradual trend towards more money going into things like equity markets. But you know, again, there are some pockets of high degrees of speculation. And these things, I think, will moderate, particularly if bond yields rise and some of the stock prices fall. We've seen some of that happening just in the very recent past. So I don't think it's going to, you know, be a very persistent phenomenon. I think we will gradually see more assets moving into equities over time from institutions and households. Mm-hmm. Bear in mind that despite the speculative activity we've seen in recent months, you know, the amount of cash sitting in money market funds in the US and indeed in other places is extraordinarily high. So, you know, it's not as if this is really coming from a significant increase in overall leverage. So I think we'll see gradual increases in exposure to equity markets over time.
As you mentioned, some sort of pockets of speculation or high speculation, what would be your view on tech stocks? You know, I mean, the famous, you know, Facebook, Amazon's, you know, Alibaba's, Netflix and Google or Alphabet. Do you think they are overpriced or do you, and what is your view on like investors sort of still ignoring the threat of higher regulation of that's actually is likely to hit all these sort of internet-based platforms?
Yeah, no, I don't think they are necessarily overpriced. I mean, actually, if you look at the so-called FANG, the biggest five companies in the US, for example, and their sort of technology or technology platform, social media companies, they've become a very large part of the market. And over time, you may get other technologies that grow with companies that grow much more rapidly. But we also have to recognize that these companies and the technology sector have not just been a leading part of the equity market globally in price terms, but they have also been a leading part of the market in terms of earnings and profit power. They've generally achieved much stronger earnings growth in the last decade or so than the rest of the market. I mean, for example, you know, if you look at these top five companies in the US, they've seen roughly three times the average sales growth compared to the rest of the market and twice the average net income growth over recent years. And even in this downturn, you know, in the recession that we've been describing, when, you know, the rest of the market experienced a contraction in revenues, these companies were actually still growing their revenues quite strongly. So they've been seen to be quite defensive as well. Of course, there's a question about valuation. They are so-called long duration. They're expected to grow their earnings well into the future. And longer duration assets tend to see their valuations go up as the cost of capital falls, as the risk-free rate falls. And if bond yields, as we were just discussing, edge higher, then the net present value of those cash flows comes down a bit. And we've seen some modest corrections in some of these parts of the market. But, you know, I do think that technology is still going to be a very important driver of economies as the digital revolution continues. In fact, to broaden out away from pure technology companies, really to disrupt and impact virtually every industry. So, you know, generally speaking, I think that you know, technology is still going to offer some very attractive returns to investors over the medium to long run.
And you would still think so, despite the talk about tightening regulation of technological companies?
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of these particular companies, of course, have become very, very large indeed and very dominant in their industries. And there's a history of antitrust regulation in different markets trying to break down natural monopolies that have grown up, and we've seen this in other technological waves in the past. We saw it in the software, for example, in the late 1980s. We saw it with the telecom companies, which were in the US, which were broken up. And we saw it, of course, famously with Standard Oil, when oil was the real driver of growth in the early part of the 20th century. So, but bear in mind that even in these situations, the companies that were broken up or were open to competition, many of them still thrived and did very well. They were just broken up into different parts. I certainly think that focus on potential higher regulation is going to slow their growth rates. And of course, other innovations in other parts of technology may well grow at a much more rapid rate, whether it's in robotics or 5G technology or other waves of technology that we're seeing, which may create some other very significant and large companies over time. But overall, I think that technology in its broadest sense is still going to be a very important part of the growth opportunity in economies and markets for some time. I should say also that, technology is broadening into other industries. That's true now increasingly in financial services, in the retail sector, in the auto sector, and even in very traditional areas like energy, where, coupled with the decarbonisation revolution, we're seeing very significant innovations in technology, which is bringing down the cost of capital and creating very high growth rates as well.
That probably brings me to, I believe, what's going to be my closing question, and we may continue if you want to add something more. But when I was getting ready for this interview, I read somewhere that you mentioned an opinion that, in your view, investors will actually get focused even more than in the past on ESG stocks, that is, environmentally, socially, and from the government's perspective, focused companies, yeah, than they were before the pandemic. What makes you think so?
I think that, in my view, for lots of the reasons we've discussed, we're in very unusual environment, but we're also in a very uniquely exciting environment, because we're seeing the impact of really two revolutionary forces in economies. One of them, if you could describe, as the digital revolution, the information revolution, and that's obviously well underway. It's been going on for the last 20 years, but is really accelerating, if anything, now, disrupting lots of industries and the way that they operate. But at the same time, we're moving into this decarbonisation revolution, which I think is very, very exciting indeed. And it's going to create big changes in the ways that economies operate and businesses too. And I think that's in its infancy. It has a long way to go. And obviously, as more governments commit themselves legally to net zero, they are going to have to provide the regulatory certainty and clarity, and also the opportunity set for investment to come in to achieve those ambitions. Now, ESG is also important, I think, because societal expectations are shifting in terms of what's expected of governments, of companies, and their impact not just on shareholder returns, but on stakeholders, the environment, on the way that they source their materials, and so on. And I think that's a good thing. And of course, more and more custodians of capital, pension funds, insurance companies, and sovereign wealth funds are wanting to invest in ways that they believe are creating good returns on investment and positive in an ethical and socially responsible way. So I think these trends are going to continue. Now, the focus on decarbonisation in particular could very easily have been a casualty of this downturn, big collapse in growth. It could have been an excuse for governments to forget about decarbonisation and the environment. In fact, it's really been seized on as an opportunity, and governments can see that this crisis has created an opportunity for them to borrow more at record low costs, given where interest rates are, but also to invest in things in the future that they think are going to generate good returns, both socially and economically. And I think this is one of them. So while we have seen in the very recent past many companies in the renewable space, for example, correcting from the higher valuations we were seeing because of the impact of rising bond yields, I do think that this area is going to provide very good growth opportunities for investors. And I think more capital is going to go into renewables and technologies to help to capture carbon, clean hydrogen, battery technology, and so on, all of which will help to achieve these ambitions of net zero. And that's, I think, very exciting indeed.
Says Peter Oppenheimer, Europe's head of micro research at Goldman Sachs. Thank you for having with us today.
Thanks very much for having me.